Good afternoon. This is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Starting last week, Wavelength is exploring auto-destructive art and music for a few weeks. I announced last week that there had been a conference at UCLA on June the 4th called Sonic Doom, Decay and Destruction in Music, but that event was apparently cancelled. And I've had no response from them. I suppose the conference might have destroyed itself. This week's guest is David Toop, who has just curated a show called Blow Up, Exploding Sound and Noise, London to Brighton, 1959 to 1969. That show opens this evening at the Flat Time House, Bellenden Road, SE15. David Toop is a distinguished musician, curator and writer on music and sound art, author of The Rap Attack and Haunted Weather, as well as numerous articles for The Wire, The New York Times and The Village Voice. In 2000, he curated Sonic Boom at the Hayward Gallery, not to be confused with Sonic Doom, the ill-fated conference at UCLA mentioned earlier. The catalogue of Sonic Boom is now a rare book, apparently. Welcome to the show, David. I keep meaning to get the theme tune to Mission Impossible. This message will self-destruct in 1 minute. Was it Mission Impossible mounting this show?
Well, it wasn't Sonic Doom. Right. It was a long job. I mean, you might say that it extends back to about 1966 or something, but I've been working on it for a year now, and I had the idea from it came from a number of different strands, but once the idea coalesced, I decided it would be good to do it in collaboration with somebody else. So I've been talking to Tony Harrington, who is managing editor at The Wire, about some of the ideas, and he was interested, so I said, let's do it. And I did a show of my own at Flat Time House last year. Flat Time House is the house where John Latham lived and worked until his death a few years ago. And I'd spoken about this exhibition to the acting curator there, Elisa Kay. She was very keen. So it seemed to me a good opportunity to bring together a lot of different ideas that didn't normally go together and do something that was quite polemical.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a small space, you know, so
right.
But it's a complicated kind of show.
Yeah.
Hence the year's preparation time.
It's a very specific time frame, isn't it? It's say, and also London to Brighton, which might sort of confuse some people, which
yes.
I mean, that's something to do with Jeff Keane, I imagine, and his
films. It was because Jeff, that was one strand that was important. And Jeff, of course, lived in Brighton, so it was not really correct to say just London.
Right.
So it's a slightly awkward
time. So he's the Brighton connection,
Jeff is the Brighton connection.
And
that's
he's famous for his sort of animated films or pixelated films. Are they mostly on Super 8 or 16 as well?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not really a film person. But
he did this thing called Dr. Gaz, I think, didn't he? With his sort of cartoon characters.
Yeah.
But I'm not... How does he... I'm not quite sure how he fits in with the blow up aspect.
Okay, so this is like a complex web, and I'll try not to make it into a cloud of unknown. But one of the strands is Jeff's work and his collaboration with Bob Cobbing and Anna Lockwood.
Right.
When I was at school, that's when I got interested in destruction in art. 1965-66, I bought the famous Art and Artists Auto-Destructive issue, which you have on your mixing desk there. And like I say, I was at school, but I was going out to galleries, I was going to all the gigs, I was going to events, I was going to, you know, all these things. I was, in a sense, I was too young for some of that stuff. So missed some of the key events, but other things I came across had a profound effect on me. That was one of these examples. I also went to the ICA when it was still in Dover Street before it moved to its present location, and I bought a poster by Jeff Keane.
Oh, right.
This Dr. Gaz poster.
It's like Ray Day or something.
These Ray Day posters he did. And it was very cheap, which was lucky because I didn't have much money. And it sort of sat there for a long time. And somebody did a piece for The Wire about Jeff Keane last year. Mm. And I thought, you know, that poster had quite an effect on me. So I pulled it out. And it became part of this strange web of connections that I was trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
So another aspect came from a conversation with Noah Latham, John Latham's eldest son.
Right.
I did a collaboration with John Latham for his last solo show at the Listen Gallery just before he died. I did just a small sound piece.
When was this?
Oh, 96 or something.
Uh-huh.
What am I talking about? 2006, maybe.
Right. Yeah.
So I was having a conversation with Noah, and he said, did you know that John had asked Joe Harriet to make a sound piece for his film, Speak, this kind of very hectic, abstract film he made in the early 60s? And I mean, no, I was flabbergasted. And what I realized was that there was this whole unknown connection going on there, that Joe Harriet used to go and play the piano in John and Barbara Latham's house in Portland Road in Holland Park. And in fact, I met Coleridge Good, who played some of the free jazz material with Joe Harriet, the bass player, at John and Barbara Latham's barn in the mid-70s. So this was all very intriguing.
Mm.
And I also knew that John had asked Pink Floyd to make a track for the same film.
Right.
Now, he rejected both these tracks. It's fantastic you think of rejecting Joe Harriet and Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Too musical, he said, in both cases.
Right. Okay.
So the sound he used ultimately for this film Speak was the sound of him cutting up books on an electric saw, just this noise piece.
Right.
Now, in 68, I'd been to this event at Middle Earth Club in London called Float, and I'd seen John Latham cutting up books on a big, electric saw, circular saw, and I thought this was fantastic.
Mm.
He had it mic'd up, and you know the noise was tremendous, and he was just cutting up these kind of pulp books, and I picked up one of the fragments and took it home with me.
Oh, right.
And started to write poetry from this cut-up book. But, you know, all these things, they began to come together. And I think what I really wanted to do was just to take all these pieces, which, I mean, let's face it, when people talk about the 60s now, you tend to kind of go immediately to sleep, or I do anyway. It's just like the 60s.
Yeah.
Because all the pieces are in place now, and everybody is fairly certain about how it all went together. So I was interested to just kind of reconfigure it all, you know, make different connections. And one of the things I think was that, you know, Joe Harriet was given a pretty hard time, partly because he was black. There was a lot of racism, even in the jazz scene at that time. He was a complex character, and he was playing free improvised music at the beginning of the 1960s. So those three elements, you know, it's a bad combination. And he, like Syd Barrett from Pink Floyd, he had a fairly tragic end.
Oh, did he? Okay.
But I really wanted to place him differently, you know, to in a way, just to pull him out of the jazz trajectory for a moment and say, well, actually, he knew all these people.
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted to do. It's just that he couldn't find a way to do it.
Hmm.
So you read these stories of Joe Harriet playing at the ICA, and William Burroughs is in the audience, and William Burroughs thinks Joe Harriet's fantastic. And you just get the sense that if he'd only been able to move sideways a bit, then life could have been different for him.
Right, right. So what else is in the show? Can you describe the exhibition? I mean, is Joe Harriet represented by, I mean, are you playing music? Is there sort of self-destructive music?
There is self-destructive music in the sense that certain things are playing simultaneously. So it is a real noise show.
Uh-huh.
And I had a crisis for a long time, you know, how to present a show like this. It's always difficult with shows that involve sound or shows where there is no visual component to speak of. You know, like a musician like Joe Harriott, they got up on the bandstand, they played. They didn't talk much about their work. You know, there's not much to go on. So I was talking to Tony Harrington about this, and we thought Val Wilmer's photographs, I mean, she took stunning photographs of all these people. You know, she's got this fantastic visual archive of music in this country that's jazz related. And okay, well, let's get Val's photos in there. So we've got a photo of Joe Harriott, early 60s, a photo of Coleridge Good. And we've also got another one of Val's photos, this historic picture of John Lennon, Yoko Ono, John Stevens and John Chikai playing in Cambridge in 69. Because I also wanted to show John Stevens' drawings, which have never really been shown before. The unifying aspect to all this stuff, I think, is obviously post-war art.
Yeah.
But the Cold War.
Yeah.
You know, the threat of nuclear war. And I think it's very difficult for people who didn't grow up at that time to really appreciate how profound an effect it had.
Yeah.
Whether you were, you know, a thinking adult or a child, you know, and I was a child in the 50s, and it really haunted my dreams. And I think I felt very conscious in the 60s that this idea of autodestructive art was intimately connected with that threat that hung over everybody's head of nuclear Armageddon.
Yes, I was going to say that there was this conference at UCLA, which was apparently cancelled, called Sonic Doom, and then
I love that title.
There's your exhibition, and then I decided completely off the, you know, as a coincidence, I decided to do some programs around autodestructive art. And do you think there's sort of something in the air at the moment, which is a sort of perhaps a revival of finality or something?
Well, I believe there is. Yeah, there is. There isn't a new Cold War in the same sense, but there is a growth of nuclear, a talk, let's say, about nuclear threat, and then of course there is constant, you know, environmental crisis,
yes,
which is mounting environmental crisis. So, you know, at the moment, it's obviously with what's happened with this BP oil spill.
Yeah,
it's just unavoidable, and I think very oppressive and depressing for anybody who cares about the environment. So, in that sense, I think it is very much in the air.
I'll just read as a brief extract from this is about John Latham. Who apparently, this is one of his sort of early actions, I think it was in 1966. August 1966, John Latham was then a part-time teacher at St. Martin's School of Art, and he borrowed a copy of Clement Greenberg's collection of essays, Art and Culture, from the college library. He invited his students, including Barry Flanagan, fellow artists and critics, to his home for an action entitled Still and Chew. The guests were urged to chew individual pages of the book, and then the chewed paper was dipped in sulfuric acid, converting cellulose to sugar and neutralised with sodium bicarbonate. Mixed with yeast, the solution bubbled away for months. When the library demanded the return of the book, the artist brought the book back distilled in a glass bottle with a label stating its contents. His dismissal followed soon afterwards. So that was 66.
It's an iconic piece, isn't it? I mean, it's like Cage's 4 minutes 33 seconds. It's one of those pieces that everybody comes
and
back
to. And sort of led to the destruction of his career, certainly his teaching career.
Yeah, which is not necessarily a bad thing, I think, but perhaps inconvenient at the time. But, you know, that piece has gone down in history as one of the turning points in a way,
and
it's something that you hear very young artists talk about now with a sense of awe. Almost.
Yes, yes.
But you have to remember that these critics like Clement Greenberg had a highly exaggerated influence in the art world of that time, and their views were very taken very, very seriously. And John's idea was that it was still a book. Mm. It was just a book on a different time base.
Right, right. And, yeah. It transformed itself into
something
else.
Yeah, because the greater the importance of these critics like Clement Greenberg, the more it takes art away from what it actually is, which is these actions and events based on, you know, instinct and so on, into the world of text, into the world of rationality, into the world of, you know, definitive notions of what is and isn't art. And, you know, John just dealt with that one by just eating it.
Right.
Which is act of genius.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And then there was Metzger, wasn't there? Gustav Metzger.
Gustav, fantastically important and still very active, of course. And, you know, amazing. And again, you know, I think young artists look at people like Gustav and John Latham and think, you know, these were really radical artists, you know. If you're looking at how to be as an artist in 2010, these are the kind of great role models.
Yes.
I mean, even Damien Hirst has said, you know, John Latham was, you know, the all-time rebel. Right. So, you know, there's a lot of respect there. But Gustav, his acid paintings, all of those works had a huge effect on me when I was still at school in the 1960s. And I think what really struck me, and this again was drawn into the blow up exhibition. Last year I went to his show at the Serpentine Gallery, and I saw his manifesto for Destruction in Art from 1959. And he'd handwritten on the manifesto, he'd obviously had an afterthought and handwritten in that amplified sound could be, you know, another material to be used. And I thought, well, this is great. You know, this is part of the history of noise, right? And this is an artist, you know. So again, you know, it's trying to expand the discourse, I suppose, trying to expand the debate about what comes from where and what goes where, what goes together, and how does it all link together? And you know, Gustav's ideas, again, at that time, they were so prophetic. You know, he was writing about environmental catastrophe and the boom-bust cycle, you know, the contradictions of capitalism in the mid-60s, you know, when everybody else was talking about the white heat of technology.
Right.
And, you know, the coming leisure age and all the rest of it. Gustav knew exactly what was going to happen. He was absolutely right. If you read what he wrote and what he lectured on at that time, it's absolutely spot on. So these people who are completely sidelined in the history of art were the ones who were right.
Mm.
You know, and
how is he represented in the exhibition, Metzger?
By the manifesto.
Right.
So we've got two of them side by side. So you actually see, you almost see his thinking, you know, because you see the pencil addition where he suddenly thought sound is a part of this as well.
Yeah.
I mean, he talked about noise pollution in 65. You know, he said, you know, it's having a big effect on us psychologically, this growing noise pollution. So he was very alert, aware to what was going on.
And then there's sort of Jean Tinguely, who kind of is sort of somewhat outside of this.
The whole thing was threatening to be rather too big for the gallery.
Right.
Or our resources. So one thing I wanted to do was almost to introduce the idea of a history of noise. So that's a slightly eccentric precursor to the exhibition. You enter through Howler Monkeys, and you see James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which was a hugely important book to John Latham, because it completely, you know, it's this huge story which hardly anybody reads, which begins with this thunderclap, you know, this explosion. So you have this kind of noise, and everything is destroyed virtually on the first page of the book, and then reconfigured.
Right.
And it was one of the books that really inspired John Latham, and he made these sculptures in the 1950s based on Finnegan's Wake. So there's this precursor to noise, but I didn't really want to introduce too much art into that because then it gets too complicated. But certainly Tangley, I mean, I saw Tangley shows in the 60s, which were fantastic because everything would be broken on the second day.
Yes.
These machines that had been going frantically for 2 days would just blow themselves up
apart.
Fall apart. And I love that stuff.
I think there's a connection between him and Michael Landy, of course, who is hopefully is going to be a guest on this show in July sometime. But Landy is also kind of interested. I think he has a particular connection to Jean Tangley. But the quote, there's a quote, another quote here to do with Latham, who apparently he said he could not identify with Tangley's existentialist idea of absurdity or with Metzger's leftish revolutionary position. And later Metzger, in 1972, Metzger wrote an angry and disappointed article in Studio International, which criticised Latham's apolitical attitude. So it seems even within these three major figures of auto-destruction, they were actually not in agreement at all. It seemed like
not at all. And but isn't that very typical of small scenes? You know, it's like, you know, if you get three poets who are very similar, they all hate each other.
Okay.
And I think what it is that when you get to the point where the ideas are close enough, then the differences become magnified and become hugely important. So what you're saying is that this is me, this is what I believe, and it's different to this person who might be mistaken for me. And I think what really happens after that is that, you know, time sorts it out. So if we look now at John Latham's work and his ideas about how art fitted into society and so on, it seems anything but apolitical. You know, it seems very political. It's just not the kind of politics that was enacted during the 1970s.
Right.
It was different.
It becomes complicated, though, I suppose, because to what extent are these artists actually hoping to earn themselves a place in art history by this sort of gesture? You know what I mean? It's like everything else has been done. Now we can, what's left? How else can I get a place in art history but by being destructive?
Well, that makes it sound almost cynical.
Well, I was just going to say that might be a cynical approach. But,
yeah, I think it is a slightly cynical approach, or it's an expression of, you know, what might be fairly cynical. And I think John Latham was very, very conscious of art history and one's place in it. And he talked about the idea of the full stop, you know, that Cage is 4 minutes, 33 seconds, Ad Reinhardt's so-called black paintings, the black and white paintings that Rauschenberg made, you know, all these important mid-century ideas really proposed a difficult question, which was, well, where do you go from here? You know, black or white painting, silence, you know. It's a question that any serious artist has to ask themselves, you know, what do I do? And, of course, most people deal with it by completely avoiding the subject, but it's a problem. And John's idea was to create this whole new cosmology, if you like. I mean, his ideas about how we think and how we perceive and how we express ourselves and how we live, and Artist Placement Group was a kind of, you know, the practical wing, if you like, of that, the social engagement of those more abstruse ideas. But if you want a place in art history, then you're making life very difficult for yourself if you use concentrated acid to paint on nylon, or if you burn books, you know, because what you're saying is, I'm against the art market.
Yes.
Which means that this whole infrastructure is negated, you know, of critics and academics and museums and galleries and dealers and and buyers and all the rest of it. It's all kicked to one side. And, you know, I mean, Gustav and John, their lives, well, Gustav's still alive, but not easy lives.
No.
And not stellar careers, you know, in the sense of somebody who is very well known and earning huge sums of money for works, because, you know, the works are not, they don't fit into that collector's thing.
We should start to sort of wind up now, I think. Thank you very much to David Toop
for
coming in. If we could just give it one more sort of, perhaps you'd like to tell us, where is it? This is Blow Up, Exploding Sound and Noise, curated by David Toop and Tony Harrington. It's an exhibition which runs from the 24th of June to the 25th of July, Thursday to Sunday, 12 until 6, at 210 Bellenden Road, London, SE15. At something called the Flat Time House, which you can get, I suppose, is a website.
There's a website for Flat Time House,
yeah. Which will give you more information.
Very near Peckham Rice Station.
Right. And what should we just play out with a track that you brought along with
us? Yes, I brought some of the collaborations between Anna Lockwood and Bob Coving, which are very experimental tape pieces.
Right.
Very noisy.
Which has now gone to sleep, so just... we'll start it up again, because it's been sitting there for so long. Any particular track, does it matter?
I don't think so. They're all pretty startling.
You know, when it dates, what did you...
These are around 60, 68.
Okay, so this is Bob Cobbing...
Bob Cobbing and Anna Lockwood.
Anna Lockwood.
Iki, 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 iki Ichi, 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 ichi,